Following podcast contains explicit language. Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, April 15th, the Toddler Ponzi Schemes edition. I'm Dan Kois. I'm a writer at Slate. I'm the author of the book How to Be a Family, and I'm the dad to Lyra, who's 15, and Harper, who's 13. We live in Arlington, Virginia.
I'm Jamila Lemieux, a writer, contributor to Slate's Care and Feeding Parenting column, and co-host of Slate's Wild and Wise chat show, and mom to Naima, who is 8, and we live in Los Angeles, California.
I'm Elizabeth Newcamp. I write the homeschool and family travel blog Dutch Dutch Goose. I'm the mom to 3 littles, Henry, who's 9, Oliver, who's 6, and Teddy, who's 4, and we live in Navarre, Florida.
On today's show, we've got a question from a mom whose son received one of those send stickers to 6 people chain letters. What should a parent do to keep your kid from being embroiled in some kind of toddler sticker Bernie Madoff situation? Then, the CDC says that black women over 30 are more than 4 times as likely to suffer pregnancy-related mortality than white women. On Tuesday, President Biden proclaimed that this week is Black Maternal Health Week. So Jamila is talking with Rose Aka James from the Black Mamas Matter Alliance about the racial disparities that black mothers face during pregnancy and childbirth. And on Slate Plus, well, Schoolhouse Rock is still alive and well on Disney Plus, but might be getting a little bit dated, so we're going to pitch some topics that aren't Schoolhouse Rock songs yet, but really deserve to be. But let's start this week with a dilemma. Elizabeth, you have a dilemma and you need us to weigh in. Take it away.
I do. Okay, so as you know, we are moving to Colorado Springs, and with that move comes a change of like our whole life. And I've always said that every time we move, I'm going to evaluate our school situation based on kind of each child and the place where we are and all of that. So I'm looking at homeschool academies for the 2 oldest, and Teddy is going to preschool. Like, he needs to not be at home every day. So I've found a lovely preschool for him that he's been accepted into. It is not close to the house. It is like 25 minutes from the home we're going to be in. I have found 2 homeschool academies that would be perfect for Henry and Oliver. They're different. They meet on different days. They are also like 20 minutes to 25 minutes away from the house in different directions. There is a school that has a homeschool academy or like full-time school walking distance from our home. So the dilemma is, like, how in a pandemic do I decide, like, do I send these kids to the perfect situation for them? It's one day a week. What's a big deal? But we're driving like all around. Or like, I'm assuming that we'll be able to go to these things, that like the pandemic's at a place where we can go. But I can't go see them to evaluate, like, well, what is the difference between sending them to what I think are these ideal schools, which is like this forest school for Henry and this like art school for Oliver? Or do I just like do the thing that makes the most convenient sense and say, like, everyone's going to the school that's right back there? Or do I like send Oliver to one? Like, do I choose one kid to get to go do the best thing? I'm like completely at a loss for, at what point do I choose convenience or do I choose the best choice for each of them as individuals?
Okay, so let me follow up on this question with a question. In any case, no matter what you decide, for the 2 older boys, this will be happening once a week.
Yes. This year, okay. I'm not sending anyone to full-time school.
Okay. This is the easiest question anyone has ever asked me.
I think we have the same opinion.
You send your kids to the school that they can walk to, which is totally fine and is only one day a week. So, like, what is the worst that could happen? It's that maybe they kind of like it 80% as much as the other one day a week. And the best that can happen is that you are not in your car for like an hour and 45 fucking minutes in Colorado Springs traffic every Tuesday. That sounds like a nightmare. I feel certain that if this neighborhood school in what I'm sure is the most adorable neighborhood imaginable in Colorado Springs is good enough for you to even consider sending your kids there, it's totally great for them to go to for a day each week. They'll enjoy it. They'll enjoy walking there. They'll enjoy meeting kids from their neighborhood. And you will enjoy not sitting in the fucking car. That is my answer.
Strong cosign.
Oh, really?
Okay. The only asterisk, if one child can be plucked off this island, if you believe that going out of your way and taking one of the 3 children somewhere a little bit further away would absolutely make a tremendous difference for that child, then I would suggest doing it with one, but not all three of them.
But how do you should just pick which one you like the best? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's which one you like.
Who's your favorite kid?
Yeah. Depends on the day.
But you're already sending one kid far. You're already driving 25 minutes each way.
I could just send him somewhere local too. I just, yeah, this is true. Like, I
would encourage that myself.
Well, yeah, I know. It's just hard because I may never get an opportunity to be somewhere in which we get into schools or that we get these other opportunities only because we move so frequently, right? So right. Like you're absolutely right. Like there is a great school walking distance. And of course that's Jeff's opinion. It's just like, push them out the door. Once a week, this is great. But I also feel like, am I passing up this opportunity for like Henry to do this for a school thing, which is only available like to fourth graders? Am I passing up, you know, this opportunity? Like, do I say like, okay, well, Henry, you can do the for a school. And then in 2 years, if we're still here, like Oliver can apply to that and we'll see if he gets in. Like, I feel very much like I want to give them all these great opportunities, but you're absolutely right. Like the reason that I haven't just been like, this is a great idea is because of the driving. But in my head, I'm thinking, I'm going to meet moms from the neighborhoods who send them here. I'm going to have a nice little carpool. I'm going to be driving once a week, my little van full of kids. Someone else is going to be, I mean, I'm thinking like, you know, I'm going to develop a little community and not do the
drive. That's totally possible.
Also possible that it won't happen.
No, right. It's very likely. Where am I going to meet these people?
It's also possible that you could meet a community of parents in your own community at the school in your community.
Oh, I mean, I'm definitely going to do that. Like, I'm definitely going to be right. But I mean, I think part of the thing with this crazy school choice is that a lot of people do not end up at the school in their neighborhood, right? Like, people are choosing all these schools because every school has some thing. Mm-hmm. So they've like taken these neighborhood schools and they're not even neighbor. Like, people are going from all over the city to these different schools.
Find out why they chose the school by your house and get enthusiastic about that thing.
That's true.
There's two different ways to think about this, I think, right? One is that there's a constant battle that we fight as parents between wanting the best for our kids and then making decisions as to when good enough is fine. And it's really hard to make that decision, especially about something as big as school, because there's an enormous amount of pressure on parents, I think especially moms, to never be settling for less than the best for their kids, because it's viewed as some kind of harm that you're doing to those kids if you don't choose the quote unquote best. I mean, the counter argument to that is that society often works the best, as you might remember from the Netherlands, when people are just a lot more satisfied with perfectly fine and don't go off hunting for the best all the time for their kids, but instead work to make the thing that's perfectly fine as good as it can possibly be. So that's one way to think of it. The other way to think of it, if you want sort of a more just like, you know, pros and cons, weights and measures style, is that you can make a reasonable argument a significant amount of the benefit that your kids would get from these amazing experiences gets counterbalanced by the enormous amount of time you spend in the car getting there and the stress and difficulty that adds to your and their lives as a result.
Yeah.
Probably not all of it, but certainly it doesn't become this universal good as a result of all this time that you're in the car. And so if you're trying to figure out, well, what's the best thing? Maybe the best thing is not subjecting them to that and you to that, and instead giving them an anchor in the place, this brand new place that they're about to live, by letting them go to the school in this exact place.
I 100% agree with that. And I only want to add to put yourself in the equation. You know, like, you are the person who is going to have to do the majority of this pickup and transport, I assume, right?
Oh, yeah.
Or all of
it,
right?
I mean, this is that's essentially why, although Jeff levied an opinion, it comes down to me, because this is like I'm in charge of this aspect of how our family works. And so, because it's me, because it's my time.
Right. There's such a drastic difference between time spent homeschooling and, you know, time spent being a chauffeur. You know, and so even though you're not a school bus driver, you're still mom in the car, which means there's a podcast and a snack and an anecdote. It just, it is going to, I think, compromise your own quality of life in a way that doesn't necessarily seem worth it.
This is a really...
All right, so we've weighed in. Great news. Okay. Once again, these decisions are legally binding.
That's it.
So I can't wait. I can't wait to hear the good news from Jeff.
No, this is really good because it's definitely like count, like my, you know, my instinct is to like put everyone at the different schools and and run everybody around and figure out how to make it work. So this is good. And I have to make a decision soon.
Is to sacrifice your own comfort for a perceived best opportunity for your children.
Yeah. But
part of the argument is that it's not only your own, as Jamila says, your situation matters and you need to be part of the equation. And B, it's not only you who suffers from those long drives and from a lack of connection.
Some of the kids are going to be in the car. And sometimes I'm going two times, like, because, you know, preschool is half day and this. Yeah. Okay.
When we have to start recording the podcast at like 9 o'clock local time to accommodate Elizabeth's school schedule.
I can't wait to find out which of your kids is your favorite.
Yeah.
Come back with a full report when this decision is made and our listeners will eagerly anticipate knowing what happens. And I can't wait to tell you what a great decision you made or yell at you. All right. Before we get to our listener question this week, let's talk some business. In Slate Plus this week, we are throwing it back to Schoolhouse Rock. We're talking about what 21st century problems you wish there were Schoolhouse Rock songs to explain. Here's a little bit of what you'll hear if you have Slate Plus. Oh, you know what we need is one on tipping in restaurants. Like there should be one about how you just always should tip in restaurants. It doesn't matter. It should be like a catchy tune that goes like, start at 20, honey, and go up from there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just spitballing here, but that seems like that'd be good. To hear segments like that and to get ad-free podcasts, sign up for Slate Plus. Slate Plus members get benefits like zero Zippo nada ads on any Slate podcast. They get bonus episodes of shows like Slow Burn and Dear Prudence. And you'll be supporting the work we do here on Mom and Dad Are Fighting. It's only $1 for the first month to sign up. Go to slate.com/momanddadplus. If you want to be notified about everything that's going on in the Slate Parenting Cinematic Universe, sign up for the Slate Parenting Newsletter. Besides getting all of Slate's great content in one place, including links to every new Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Ask a Teacher, Care and Feeding, etc., etc., you'll get much, much more. It's just an email from me. It's a letter from me to you right into your inbox every week telling you a story, complaining about cicadas, something new. Sign up at slate.com/parenting email. And finally, if you are looking to connect with other parents, to throw some questions out there, to look for some recommendations, just to look for a little bit of moral support, join our parenting group on Facebook. Super active. It's also moderated, so the jerks get cleared out. Just search for Slate Parenting on Facebook.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Okay, let's get into our listener question this week. It's being read, as always, by the fabulous Sasha Leonard.
Dear Mom and Dad Are Fighting, our 1.5-year-old son received some mail from his 3-year-old cousin. I peeked in and saw Sticker Club and some stickers and thought, oh, neat. It wasn't until the next morning when I opened the package with him at breakfast that I realized what had been delivered. A chain letter. I thought these had died with AOL email addresses. You know the drill. Send stickers to the person listed in spot 1, a friend of our niece who we don't know, then copy the letter and send to 6 people, and so on and so on. The letter also says, if you cannot do this in 6 days, Please let my mom know because it is no fair to all the other kids who have participated so far. I do not want to pass on this burden to anyone else. Do we just send stickers to the first kid? Do we forge 6 separate letters to our niece? Can I ignore it entirely? What should we do?
So my instinct, being a prisoner of boredom for the past year, is to say, just do it because it's a thing to do. With the asterisk that this project could very well end up on my dining table where creative projects go to die. There are so many there, from my taxes to a decoupage table that I'm making. But this sounds like a thing to do, right? But I understand that Elizabeth has done some investigative reporting into the art of the chain letter that might give us some pause. So I'm saying go for it, but my answer is likely to change after we've heard Elizabeth out.
Elizabeth, tell us what you've learned.
So first of all, chain letters involving money are illegal. So everyone should know that if you are asked to like send money and then you're going to get more money, right? That is illegal.
It's literally a Ponzi scheme.
It's literally a Ponzi scheme. Okay.
Yes.
So I had to go look up a version of this letter because I needed to know what it promised. But I basically tried to figure out how many people would have to be involved for everyone to get their, I think what I looked up said like that you're going to get 36 stickers or something like that in 10 weeks. Anyway, the point is, when I did the math, in order for your child to get the stickers, which I know you don't care about, but 12 million people would have to be involved for your child to end up with the stickers.
What?
Yes, because it's like they say after 10 weeks, everyone's going to get 36 packs and you need to send it to 6 people, but you end up at the bottom of the letter.
So basically, in order for everyone at your level of the scheme
yes.
to get all their stickers,
yes. to get all
that's how many people would have to have eventually been
yes.
involved.
Yes. Yeah.
But all you need to get your 36 stickers is just for the right 36 people to happen to get the letter and say, sure.
The idea is like, will you just send it to the first person and then mm-hmm. you put your name at the bottom and you move it up and you're going to get 36 packs.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time you move from 6 up, okay, anyway, whatever that number is, if you then estimate a really, let's say like a cost of stickers, I somehow ended up with the number of like $54 million in stickers moving around in order for your child to get 36 stickers. Because if there's 12 million people and they each need to send... send 6 packs of stickers, okay?
This is a great ProPublica sponsored at like a 10 reporter okay. investigation in the chain letters, and the results will shock you.
My point is, do not get involved in this mess. First of all, your child is one. They don't care.
The child is one. Oh, okay.
The child,
yes.
is one,
the child
yes.
that sent
I don't
the letter
know how I didn't
is three. It's a little young for organized crime, is all I'm saying.
Okay, I didn't think. Okay. Oh, I got excited because it was a chain letter and I hadn't seen one since I was a kid. And so I saw the 3-year-old and I thought that this was really the parents of 3-year-olds doing this. I did not realize that there was a 1.5-year-old involved, which somehow is worse. I think I'm taking back my answer, even though I would love to see the math on that, Elizabeth. I'm dying to know.
It's just that gif of the person with all the numbers flashing in front of their
we
face.
We had to like come up with it out like the computer to run the numbers.
Right. It's possible that computer is no computer sophisticated enough has been invented yet.
Yeah. To run the numbers on this, on the sticker club Ponzi scheme.
I think you should just do it because this is the one chance to do one of these stupid chain letters where it won't matter that it will never work and your kid won't get any stickers because your kid's only one and will never know any better. So just do it. Who cares? But when your kid gets older, definitely don't do it, because my number one memory of these chain letters is doing this exact chain letter in the year 1981 when I was 6, sending off my 6 packs of stickers to all the people on the top of the list and never getting a single fucking sticker in the mail from anyone.
Yeah, because why?
It's a scam.
Like, you're not even helping your niece. Like, I think the best solution to this, if she feels like she needs to to send something. And honestly, my real problem, other than it being illegal,
it's not a lot.
Sending money.
You're
not sending money. Sure. Yeah.
Everyone knows what stickers mean.
Yes, stickers. Send me stickers. No, but it's like, okay, I'll just say what really bothers me is this idea of the guilting, which is what chain letters do, right? And there are obviously like the ones that go around by email, like we all, you know, delete them. Like no one is going to come kill you or whatever the chain letter says if you don't do the thing. I don't like that it's like, or tell my mom so that what, you can send it out like to other people. Like nobody is getting their stickers. Even if you send the sticker to the person, the number one spot, like your niece is still not getting stickers. So if what you feel bad about is that you want your niece to get stickers, just send your niece some stickers.
It is insane to me that the parents of the three-year-old was like, yeah, let's do this. I would like to know more about the relationship here.
The idea of being unfair to the other kids who participated is so, and maybe that is just part of the language that's circulating in the letter, but also who sent it to a three-year-old? Like, how did it get there in the first place? Like, is your niece starting the chain? Like, is this where this particular chain begins with your niece?
Maybe, no, it started at least with a friend beyond
because
her.
She's in spot number one.
She's in spot number one. Okay. I think that you should just buy your niece a pack of stickers and send it to her and say, here, this is for your sticker scheme you're doing. We're not going to participate, but since you need, you know, if you need to send stickers out to people, here you go. So like you're helping her in her work.
Do you guys not understand that chain letters like this are the only way we're going to save the U.S. Postal Service? The very service that delivers our ballots every presidential election?
Send six stickers to six people. Don't require and say, pay it forward.
I think I still come out on Jamila's original side. Like, it's a 10-minute activity that at least will keep your kid occupied. So just, like, do it. Who cares? Your 1.5-year-old, 10 minutes later, won't even remember it. You'll never have to talk about it again. And at least you did something. At least you did your part for the U.S. Postal Service.
When my kids get these letters, I'm going to say, you know who you can send them to?
Lyra and Harper. Perfect.
Lyra and Harper.
Can't wait for my kids to have an activity.
They could start a sticker club, just not with money.
Though it would be very lucrative.
If my kids were going to start some kind of Ponzi scheme, what would they be trying to get? Harper would definitely start like a makeup club. Like send the person on top of this list some six makeup. Bronzers. Lyra probably would just ask for money and end up getting sent to juvie.
Are there a lot of juvie Ponzi schemers, do you think?
I have to assume it's mostly, I mean, the prevalence of chain letters suggests to me that that's mostly what kids end up in juvie for.
I think Naima would also go for makeup and perhaps TikToks if it were like you have to do these six TikTok dances or else you're in trouble.
I think I feel so strongly about this because every Christmas, do you get those like, you know, send a sister a gift thing, da 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 da. Like, send it to the top of the. It's just a chain letter, but they want you to like send something on Amazon to someone. Like, won't it be fun to get random Amazon stuff? And it's like, these are Ponzi schemes. Why have you not learned this?
Thank God I never get those.
Never gotten one of those. Yeah, is that a thing?
I'm apparently okay. If any of my friends are listening, stop sending these things to me. It always ends with me. I never delete them. I never forward them.
Send it to me. I want some presents.
Okay, I will. I'll send it to you, Jamila.
But like, great. Forward.
So the end result of this is it have to send a bunch of stickers to this lady's niece. Yeah. Apparently, is how this all ended up. Congratulations, lady. Your niece is getting like 25 stickers from me. All right. Thank you for writing in. I don't know if we really solved this or even if the math checks out.
No, it definitely doesn't.
I enjoyed Elizabeth's passion on the subject. Unmatched, perhaps, in intensity for any subject we've discussed on this show. If you got something you want to gripe about and you want to see if it's going to be the one thing that pushes Elizabeth's buttons, send us in your rant. Email us at momanddad@slate.com or post it to the Slate Parenting Facebook group.
According to the CDC, approximately 700 women die each year in the United States as a result of pregnancy or delivery complications. What's worse is that there's a tremendous disparity when it comes to race and ethnicity in pregnancy-related deaths, with Black and Native American women being 2 to 3 times more likely to die from a pregnancy-related cause than white women. In certain areas, the numbers are even worse. For example, in New York, Black women are 12 times more likely to die than white women when it comes to pregnancy-related causes. There are a number of other devastating things that are happening to Black moms and their babies during what should be the most celebratory, the most special time in their lives. Luckily, there are a lot of folks that are stepping up to address this, that have been addressing this for a very long time. And among them, there is the Black Mamas Matter Alliance. And they are hosting the Black Maternal Health Conference, the BMHC, April 16th and 17th during Black Maternal Health Week. The Black Maternal Health Conference is the premier assembly for Black women, health professionals, advocates, and decision makers working to improve maternal health outcomes using birth justice, reproductive justice, and human rights frameworks. We are very excited to have as a guest today Rose Aka James, the National Membership Director of Black Mamas Matter Alliance, to talk about the conference and about these devastating disparities that exist in the world of Black maternal health. Thank you so much for being here, Rose.
Thank you, Jamila. Thank you so much for having us and spotlighting us today.
This is a topic that I'm very passionate about. At one point, I was in training to become a doula, and I have served as a doula in a few births, moving across the country, and the pandemic have not made it super easy for me to continue on that path. But one, it was something I took on because of these statistics. But the more I got into it, the more that I learned about the experiences that Black mothers are having when trying to give birth. And since this has become a more popular topic, I guess the way that I'm looking at the births of my friends, my own birth story, and the women around me, I'm finding more often than not, there's trouble, right? I'm curious to know, what's your point of entry? How did you get involved in this work? When did you become aware that when it comes to Black women and giving birth, there's trouble? Is it something that you always knew of, that you were clear on, or something that you weren't able to really articulate until much more recently?
I've always been interested in public health and maternal and child health, but it really wasn't until I was pregnant myself with my son. I was in my master's program for public health, and my focus at the time was HIV. So I was very immersed in that world. And I actually spent a lot of time in West Africa studying about maternal and child health, where, you know, we typically hear about, you know, the global South or Africa or Asia, Southeast Asia, these places where people view as poorer places of the world having bad health outcomes, especially when it comes to maternal and child health. I happened to be pregnant at the same time while I was doing this work. And so halfway through my program, my husband and I moved here to Atlanta, where we live now. When I moved to Atlanta, I started researching hospitals of where I wanted to give birth to my son. And I knew for me, I wanted to have as natural of a birth as possible. I wanted to have a midwife. I knew I was very low risk. And I wanted to give birth in the hospital that will allow me to have freedom of movement, and I wouldn't be just restricted to what the doctor just told me. And so through that research, I really learned how bad of a situation we are here in the U.S. You know, Black women here in the U.S. are being killed 3 to 4 times more than their white counterparts, Hispanic counterparts, during and after childbirth, which is ridiculous if you think about the U.S. and, you know, how much money we spend, billions of dollars on healthcare each year. And we are recognized in the world as a developed and industrialized country. But yet, you know, Black women are still facing the brunt of a system that, frankly, doesn't really listen to us. It doesn't really respect our wishes and our values, and it's not really catered to support us. And so going through that experience myself and, you know, having a community that was supporting me and, you know, having a really great birth, it just had me thinking, why can't every Black woman have this birth? That's how I started working with BMMA about 3 years ago. So it's personal, and I always say the personal is political. So that's really my entry point into this work.
You mentioned money, mm-hmm. And the amount that is spent in this country on healthcare. Yeah. I think it's also important to mention that the mortality rates for Black mothers hold across class lines, right? So this is not a matter of, you know, if the majority of Black people in this country are poor, it stands to reason that they would, you know, have less, you know, less access to, say, prenatal care or, you know, certain other interventions that might ensure a safe pregnancy, but that, you know, upper middle class, college trained, you know,
married,
Black women,
unmarried, college degree or not, we actually know that, you know, a Black woman with a college degree is less off worse than a white woman with a high school degree when we look at maternal mortality data trends, which is, to me, it's very troubling.
Absolutely. And it speaks to the fact that there's not just one thing that we can point to, right? We can't say this is because of hypertension or this is because of diet. This is because, you know, that there are so many factors, including medical racism throughout one's life that could lead them to a negative outcome during pregnancy. Rose, for someone who is Black and preparing to at some point bear a child, this is, you know, incredibly stressful information to take in. I'll say, I had a child at 28. I read nothing. I did no preparation. You know, I just kind of want, you know, I was winging it in a lot of ways. And I realized I was incredibly fortunate, you know, because the women that I know, and also, you know, it's been almost a decade later. So my friends that are having kids now are also having kids at a different stage of life. But what I see around me is that, you know, the women in my circle are taking a lot of care and energy to pay attention to what they're eating or, you know, the questions that they're asking their doctor because of this mortality crisis. So I have a twofold question. One, how can Black people that are preparing to have children, best prepare themselves for a happy, healthy, safe birth? Two, how do you suggest that Black birthing persons of the future, be they Black moms or otherwise, take in this information, right? Because you should not, it's not that we should look away from this crisis, but this is a lot of stressful information to take in when you're thinking about your fertility and you're thinking about what might happen to you, you know, if you're going into the hospital or if you're currently pregnant and you're listening to something like this and you're reading about these things.
Yeah, we hear these statistics. Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die. And I think that can be very terrifying for some folks, like you're saying. And so with BMMA, we're really thinking about reframing the narrative. Black women are not showing up to birth wanting to die. It's a system that's not set up for them, which is killing them or harming them during the birth process, whether it's before, after, or during. So I think, one, taking the blame off of us and realizing that it's not our problem that this system is not set up to protect us and it's not doing its job to ensure that we are having safe and healthy and happy deliveries and pregnancies and then, you know, postpartum and all these experiences across the reproductive health spectrum. I think, one, putting that blame back, shifting that and saying, hey, it's not me, you know. Yes, everybody can do things to, you know, take care of themselves and, you know, prepare their body. But at the end of the day, we're seeing it can be perfectly healthy and you could still have a negative experience or, you know, you can be a whole doctor or a whole professor and you can still experience maternal mortality or morbidity. So I think for us, it's really putting the onus on the systems that are put in place that are not helping us and really thinking about what the systems change look like. How do we amplify the solutions within our communities? That includes Black midwives, doulas, lactation consultants, that are, you know, fully versed in our culture and our traditions and there to embrace us as a safety net throughout this entire process. And then your other question, I like to talk about, you know, thinking about having a baby and, you know, or even exploring, you know, becoming pregnant, you know, with this information. You know, I've been working with BMMA for about almost 3 years now, and I just had a baby 6 months ago. And so, you know, knowing the work that I'm doing, knowing these statistics and being so intimate with the details and knowing things. I remember when I was pregnant with my daughter, there was moments I was terrified, even though I had really good providers. I had a doula, a really incredible doula, and a whole community and support system. I remember the day going into labor, going to the hospital, even though I know this hospital is incredible and they respected my wishes the first time and I knew they were going to do it again this time. There was still that fear, that inherent fear of being a Black woman walking into this place. And, you know, when a moment that I am supposed to be at ease, as much as ease as I can, because we know labor is hard. But, you know, as much ease as I can to prepare my body and my mind to bring this human being into this world, having that additional fear or burden on there is something that my white counterparts do not think about or have to deal with. And so thinking about that additional stress that's put on us in general in society on a daily basis, and then coming into this experience of even having that. And so I think, you know, of course, inform yourself as much as you can. Asking a friend or, you know, who has had a positive experience with a provider that, you know, that can recommend you for. Thankfully, you know, this week is also Black Maternal Health Week. And on Saturday, we highlighted some incredible new technology that's being developed by Black women for Black maternal health, particularly the Earth app by Kimberly Seals Ayers, where it's basically like Yelp. And so you can be like, hey, girl, I went to this provider and, you know, I didn't feel good about this experience. And then people can go in and look and see that. So I think it's really, like I said, putting the onus back on these systems that are not providing for us and taking care of us in the way that they would our white counterparts. And then also knowing that our power and our resilience is in our communities and our families. You know, we continue to, you know the solutions that work best for us. And so I think having a community, having a village that's supporting you in this process, and that includes your provider, your doula, your mama, your sister, your partner, we need to start having these conversations within our families, our communities about, you know, what is really going on and, you know, how we can support each other and make sure that we are our own best advocates within our community around us that we center ourselves in is also advocating for us in the process. So we are doing the work at BMMA, and all the organizations that are part of our alliance are doing the work just to secure a safe future for Black mamas. And today, incredibly, we just got news that President Biden signed a resolution officially recognizing Black Maternal Health Week and the work that BMMA is doing and all the organizations that are part of our alliance who are really revolutionizing what it means to have community-based care for Black mamas.
So speaking of the work being done, how can folks be supportive, Rose?
We have a whole list on our website of our partners who are around the country, and they do all types of community-based work, from doula-based organizations, lactation consultants, legal, whatever it is, these incredible organizations are doing it. So you can connect with them by visiting our website, www.blackmamasmatter.org. And in terms of supporting BMMA directly, you know, we always direct folks to sign up for our newsletter by also visiting our website. Follow us on socials. You know, we live in a digital age where, like, you know, everybody's wanting to seek information. And so really following us on our socials is a great way to learn about a whole bunch of things and ways that you can get involved with the work that we're doing and our partners are doing in their communities as well.
So I know that registration for the conference this weekend is closed, but there are, one, I believe there are some events that are public, and two, people will be able to access some of the, some recaps and some footage from the conference in the weeks to come, right?
Yes, of course. You know, we'll be sharing recaps from the conference on our socials and on our website. So definitely stay tuned for that. We also have a lot of things in our resources section on our website. And if you couldn't join us this year, make sure you stay tuned and you join us next year for sure.
Thank you so much, Rose, for all of your work and for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Jamila.
All right, we've come to the part of the show where we choose individual items or concepts to recommend to you, our listeners. After years of debate, I've decided to call this segment Recommendations. All right, Elizabeth, what do you have for us?
I am recommending a book, and it's not about Ponzi schemes, but it's called Plasticus maritimus, an invasive species by Ana Pego. And Ana is a Portuguese marine biologist, and she wrote this beautiful book. It's been translated into English. That is kind of a reference book about oceans and pollution. And one of the things I love about it is that it's beautifully illustrated, but it approaches the problem from a really like specific nature. Like it talks about why it is so hard to solve this pollution ocean problem and why it is so important. And then it essentially invites kids like, here are some ideas we've had. Here's why they sort of work. Here's why they don't work. What other things can you think about? And because of the illustrations, it's really accessible to any of the kids to look at. We also like to all read it together. But I really love that it truly presents the problem as complex, because I think so many children's books sort of say we just need to go do a beach cleanup. And it's like, yeah, that's part of it. But this is a larger problem. And we're really going to have to address, you know, this beach pollution and this plastic that's in the ocean in a more serious way in a lot of different ways. So I really enjoy that. The book is beautiful. And again, it's called Plasticus Maritimus, an Invasive Species.
Good one. Jamila, what about you?
So I recently had to throw away all of my cookbooks. Not that I had a ton of them, but they'd gotten wet and pretty messed up. And I realized I'd been carrying most of them around for years without opening them up, just moving them from kitchen to a kitchen, city to city, in part because when I want to find a recipe, there's Google now. I can just like look it up on the internet machine as opposed to having to go into an actual book. And two, because I'm, you know, not really doing as much creative cooking as I like to. So I ended up deciding that I would purchase a cookbook for now. And I got Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. I know this is a huge book that everybody, you know, that's really into cooking and food had something to say about when it first came out a couple of years ago. But I, a person who's not interested in the culinary arts, completely looked away, aside from the fact that the title of it, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, just kind of makes me hungry because it sounds like some sort of really well-seasoned meat, even though I actually don't eat red meat. Just having it for a couple of weeks, I've learned so much already just about like the science of cooking, which is something that I don't think I've known a lot about. I know a little bit about baking. But anyway, if you want to be a better cook, if you want to learn how to properly salt your fish, for example, did you know that you're supposed to do that like 15 minutes before you cook it as opposed to like immediately or as you're cooking it, as I've done in the past? You can learn a lot from this book. So Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat by Samin Nosrat. It is an incredibly well illustrated and fun exploration through the art of cooking.
Two recipes I love in that book: the conveyor belt chicken. It's an extremely simple, just a way of cooking chicken thighs, basically, that makes them crispy and juicy and great. And then her Persian-ish rice, which is basically a way to make tadik, but a little bit easier and a little bit less likely to fail completely, as every attempt I had previously made to make that great Iranian rice dish with the crusty bottom. I'd always failed before, but I always succeed with Samin's recipe. It's awesome.
Very cool book. What do you have for us, Dan?
I'm recommending a children's book series, probably best for second or third graders, kids who really like Captain Underpants or Big Nate, the sort of genre of chapter books with tons of drawings to fool kids into thinking they're not really reading a chapter book. The books I'm recommending are called The Cookie Chronicles. They're by Matthew Swenson and Robbie Bear. There are many reasons I like them, but one is that they have the appeal of Captain Underpants without being quite as stupid as Captain Underpants. They're, I think, a little smarter and more thoughtful while still being very enjoyable and funny. They follow a third grader named Ben Yokoyama and his best friend Janet and the kids in his class. And in each book in the series, he finds a fortune in a fortune cookie and has that fortune sort of starts to take over his life as he tries to follow it. In the first one, he tries to live every day as if it were your last. In the second one, he tries to figure out if good things really come to those who wait. They're very charming, very fun. The authors are a married couple who live somewhere near me, I think, in like out on the Eastern Shore in Maryland. And they're really fun, and the books are really fun. They're called The Cookie Chronicles. The first one is called Ben Yokoyama and the Cookie of Doom. The second one is Ben Yokoyama and the Cookie of Endless Waiting. I think kids would really like them.
They sound perfect for Henry. I'm going to.
Yeah.
This might be our road trip book series for him. Sounds great.
He's in the sweet spot for that. Yeah, I think so. All right. So that's it for our show. One last time. If you want us to weigh in on your quandaries, send us an email, momanddad@slate.com. You can also post it to the Slate Parenting Facebook group. Find that by just searching for Slate Parenting on Facebook. And obviously, if you haven't already subscribed, you should subscribe to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, the very podcast you just listened to. Do that wherever you listen to podcasts. Just mash that subscribe button. Every time someone does that, a little bell goes off in my house and Slate sends me a dollar. It helps us out. You'll never miss an episode, so it helps you out. Another thing you could do is you could rate and review the show, especially if you like us. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is produced by Rosemary Belson. For Jamila Lemieux and Elizabeth Newcamp, I'm Dan Coyce. Thanks for listening.